often a wave has no effect, since the electrons in our bodies are generally held pretty tightly to the nuclei at the center of our atoms. Our bodies are invisible to most of those fields. A radio wave will hurtle right through us. To radio waves, we are ghosts. Even the atoms inside ordinary rock or bricks are constructed in such a way that radio waves fly through, which is why we can use a cell phone inside a house. Metal is different. The atoms in iron or aluminum are more loosely constructed and are like solar systems that don't particularly care about their outermost planets. Although the majority of these atoms' electrons stay in orbit, the outermost ones are free. A strip of shiny aluminum with several billion atoms can be viewed as a galaxy of several billion stars, which all have some planets orbiting close, but have let the outer ones escape. It's as if innumerable electrically charged Neptunes or Plutos were floating loose among the stars in that galaxy, joined by similar refugees from other solar systems. That's what it's like in the metal wing of an airplane. When a radio wave storms into one of these miniature galaxies in an aircraft's metal, the innermost electrons of each miniature solar system might be buffeted a little, but they won't be knocked very far. But the more distant electrons, the errant, solitary, orphaned electrons, the ones flying loose in the miniature galaxy, are a different story. The radio wave that flies through the metal nabs them and carries enough power to start tugging them along. When this happens inside a tiny metal receiver like the one within a cell phone, the solitary electrons start wobbling. That wobble is magnified, and our crucial information, such as, "Hey, I'm in the car," is transmitted. But Wilkins realized that when a radio wave hits a much larger expanse of metal, the effect is more dramatic. In an enemy airplane, there are yards and yards of such vulnerable, waiting metal. Any radio wave we send in its direction accelerates the loose, mobile electrons there, and each electron is always surrounded by its own personal force field. If the electron is left still, that force field will be fairly still and no signal will be produced from the airplane's wing. But when the electron is made to ripple from side to side, that force field ripples as well. This was what Maxwell and Hertz had realized. By aiming a radio transmitter at the targeted plane, trillions upon trillions of electrons could be made to ripple in unison and serve as tiny bubbling radio transmitters of their own. In other words, by pumping up invisible radio waves, Wilkins could force the enemy plane to become a flying transmission station. The entire airplane turned into an antenna that could not be switched off. The big question, though, was whether the transmission would be powerful enough to be detected. For the sky is big, but radio waves are small. Most of the radio waves beamed outward would disperse and miss the airplane, or be very weak by the time they reached it. Wilkins did the calculations. Even though the launched wave might disperse so widely that only 1/1000th of its strength would be available to tug on the metal electrons in a plane 4 miles away, that would still be enough. Once again, it was the very minuteness of electrons that allowed this to work. Wilkins showed that even that diffuse a wave would make about 60 quadrillion electrons start rushing back and forth each second at any given point in the airplane's wing. The invisible radio waves generated by those rushing wing electrons would be powerful enough to detect back on the ground. Stealth aircraft, invented decades later, avoid detection partly because the paints used don't allow much incoming radar energy into the plane's metal skin, partly because the aircraft's surfaces are angled so that anything it does reflect will aim away from the original transmitter. Watson Watt had supervised Wilkins' work, sort of, so it was fair enough that when the memo went back to the Air Ministry in London, Wilkins was generously mentioned as an important collaborator. But it was Watson Watt's name alone that went on top. It helped that Britain had few alternative methods for defending against German air attacks. In World War I, blind people with excellent hearing had been placed under the likely path of incoming Gotha bombers and asked to don stethoscopes attached to large Victrola-like horns. More recently, in the early 1930s, a giant concrete ear, 200 feet long and 25 feet high, had been built on marshes near the Thames, aiming over the channel where possible enemy aircraft might emerge. Neither of those techniques worked very well. The only chance of succeeding was to create wobbles in the invisible electric force fields that stretched out from the charged electrons in transmitters. those waves would continue wobbling outward, possessing enough power to kidnap and redirect the electrons in the metal of incoming planes. It sounded like science fiction, but within 3 weeks, Watson Watt had convinced Rowe, his superior Wimpiris, and everyone else within earshot that the time was ripe for a full-scale test. He wouldn't need any special equipment. The enemy plane could just be an ordinary RAF bomber. The transmitting radio station could simply be one of the powerful BBC Empire masts at Daventry in Northamptonshire, which was already broadcasting regularly. The oscilloscope to detect the waves that would surely be flung back out by the bomber's electrons could be borrowed from a research colleague.